Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. This is an early episode for us. We're taping this on a Tuesday, the morning after the government shut down. So it's a little earlier for us in the week, Bill. How do you feel? You're normally a Wednesday guy. I don't talk to you on Tuesday.
Well, I feel like this is a glorious day for both of our tribes. I think for liberals, this is Obamacare Day. This is the first day of enrollment in the greatest liberal achievement of the decade and this new century. I think I'm gonna, you know, break open a bottle of wine and go on healthcare.gov and take it for a spin and see what it's like.
If you can, the site's been crashing a lot, but maybe you can get on it.
Well, it's because so many people want to get on. How can you blame them?
Yeah.
And for you, it's shutdown day. I mean, this comes once every 20 years for conservatives. You feel a little bit freer. The government's not on your back. You can, you know, stretch your arms, your legs, walk around town. Maybe take a nice autumn walk in a private park, maybe. What do conservatives do on a day like today?
So much to say. Well, first let me say, going back to the site crashing, I mean, under a different circumstance, the story might be this sort of sloppy rollout of the exchanges. And, of course, that story is buried, so yet another example of stepping on bad news. There is not chaos in the streets here in D.C. Things are quiet. Apparently in New York, people are being attacked by motorcycle gangs, but that's a different story. So things are pretty mellow here. I think that the truth is that, it's not going to be a horrific thing, but it's very easy to demagogue. And that's why I've always thought Republicans would be blamed for a shutdown and that it would hurt Republicans. Not nearly as much as a default, but still it'll hurt them. And the interesting thing, Bill, is to see there's this thing that I call the predictor caucus. Not the surrender caucus, but the predictor caucus. People like me who were, at least it appears, were right about this, that this would not end well, that you couldn't defund Obamacare, so it would either result in a shutdown, in which case Republicans would get blamed, or in Republicans knuckling under, in which case they look weak. That may be to come, but the question that I have personally is, do people like me, the predictor caucus, do we get credit for being right or blame for being right? That's the question.
Well, I mean, if Obamacare is this colossal disaster, I think you would eventually reap the political benefits. I think that is... That's hope and not a plan. As we were talking, I've been at healthcare.gov and it had not crashed, and I got very easily to my Massachusetts connector site. So I wouldn't put too much.
You're hilarious.
So, you know, I mean, but that is the one way this works out for conservatives if it becomes rapidly clear that Obamacare is this bureaucratic, implosion. But short of that, everything leading up to this moment, you're hearing a lot of the Republicans say, well, check the polling, Obamacare is unpopular. Well, I checked the polling. I was writing a piece for the week about this. You know, number one, yes, if you ask the question, is Obamacare, do you support Obamacare? It's generally below 50%. But number one, a chunk of the opposition is that's not liberal enough. So you look at the CNN polling, which has asked that question consistently over the last 2-3 years. Do you oppose Obamacare because it's too liberal? That percentage is in the high 30s. And then the second question is a whole range of different questions. Do you support not funding the government until this is defunded, or there's even a question out there, do you support a budget agreement that even takes a shutdown out of the equation? Do you support refusing to have a budget until Obamacare is defunded? there is nowhere close to 50% for support for that tactic. So going into this,
I do want to say, in fairness to Republicans, they did propose some compromises. They proposed a delay of Obamacare.
These aren't compromises. These are changes in demands.
The medical equipment tax, or whatever the pacemaker tax, whatever they're calling it. And then there was the Vitter Amendment, which is another option. So
these are all asking for less. There's not a single thing Republicans have done that is a concession. That is, here's something I will give to you for a compromise. This is all just, I'm now asking for a little bit less than before. There's nothing they've done that is an actual attempt to reach across and say, I will give you this if you give me that. There's none of that.
They've also asked to go to the conference, which apparently Harry Reid is.
That's not a concession.
Has declined. Well, but it's opening. My point is that despite the fact that I've spent, you know, what feels like months talking about how the defund Obamacare strategy was quixotic and badly flawed. I mean, you know, there is a government shutdown today, which could have been averted. Had Democrats been willing to play ball, they weren't. And I'll be honest with you, Bill, if I were them, I wouldn't have either. Because I think that they had a strategic advantage, which of course I foresaw.
Democrats here, I mean, there is a concession that they have made. There's a lot of Democrats that wanted to have a fight around the CR to end the sequester and spend more money. And now you have almost to the letter, you had several members of the progressive wing of the party publicly say, okay, we will accept a 2-month continuing resolution at sequester levels to keep the government open. I saw my congressman, Jim McGovern, on C-SPAN late last night saying, I detest the sequester. I think it's horrible. I think it's hurting people, but I think it's better than shutdown. And so you have a unified Democratic Party, and they actually have not been unified on this question for the last weeks. People haven't paid attention to that fact because of what's going on with the Republicans.
Has the Senate passed a bill that delays Obamacare a year but returns us to the pre-sequester spending baseline? Because if they did that, then the onus would be on the House to make a big decision.
Well, you're saying spend more money. Repeal the sequester partially in exchange for the year delay of Obamacare. That's what you're saying.
That would be a compromise.
I mean, that would be a form of compromise. I grant you that. But what Democrats says is the opposite. They're saying we're not going to talk Obamacare at all because that's
right. Well, that's my point.
We will keep the sequester in place and avert that fight. So that's the offer they've been.
So they're willing to keep. So their big concession is they're willing to basically keep the spending levels where they're at now.
Well, I'm not arguing it's a massive concession.
Right. All I'm saying is that the shutdown is bad, but if Democrats were willing to give up something, they could have averted it. That's a fact.
If the Democrats are willing to fold like a deck chair, if we wouldn't have a shutdown, fine. But the basic...
Well, if I were them, I wouldn't either.
But the basic Democrat bargaining position is to keep the government open is no ideological prize for us. It's basic housekeeping. Raising the debt limit to pay obligations of spending that Congress has already done is basic housekeeping. It's not a reward. And quite frankly, if you don't do this, Republicans, guess who gets it in the teeth? You! Your hostage man is putting a gun to your own head and blowing it off. So what incentive do I have to bail you out?
Well, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this sort of violent rhetoric and analogies, but I get your point. I think you're largely right. Here's the thing, Bill, because we could talk about this all day, but sort of gaming this out, I think, interestingly, that this benefits someone like Chris Christie. I've been thinking about this. I'm going to write about this today. Because, you know, as you know, early on, I felt like Marco Rubio would be the guy. And who knows what the future will hold. But I'm beginning to think that this is really a tailor-made opportunity for Christie. I mean, number one, all the guys in D.C. look weak, and they look like they just look childish. They can't get their act together. Christie, meanwhile, is running a state. He's in New Jersey. He's going to win big in his reelection. And I also think that his ability, his personality, which in other eras would be perceived as being bullying and you know, whatever, that sort of quality might actually come in handy now. I mean, you could see the American public during the time of chaos wanting a sort of strong man who can get things done, which he obviously can. But even just in the Republican Party, if you buy the notion that somebody needs to stand up to these folks, and I want to talk more later about why I think this is a societal trend. Is this what we're seeing now in Washington? This breakdown of leadership and what's happening now isn't. It's not about John Boehner. It's about societal trends that have made their way into politics. But I think this could be an opportunity for Christie. And look, who else could stand up? Let's say that somebody needs to stand up to Ted Cruz. Well, it's not going to be Marco Rubio. He's clearly not up to that task. He's demonstrated that. Who's the one person on the right who could stand up and tell people to shut up and sit down?
Pete King?
I think the only possible person, and clearly it's not Boehner. I think it would have to be Chris Christie.
It's not Pete King?
I think Pete King is the Spiro Agnew. He's Christie's Spiro Agnew. He's the attack dog. He says the things that allow the governor to stay above the fray for now.
But Christie is playing the, you know, anti-Washington, these numbnuts can't get their act together, shut down is failure, shut down is irresponsible. He is, you know, he is not waving the same flag that Ted Cruz is waving. Isn't this the same pickle that Christie has been in? I mean, I've always argued that, you know, yes, a more moderate-ish Republican could and often does get the nomination when the hard right fractures. But don't we still have an issue where if Cruz is the Tea Party standard bearer now, and Rand Paul is in relative decline, and Christie still has to fight off a bunch of other establishment types, that he is still on the short end of what a consolidated, unified Republican base wants.
Well, who knows how this will play out? There's so many variables. But look, I think a couple of things. Number one, I don't write Rand Paul off. I think that there's going to be a bitter battle between Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, as I've always said. They're fighting for the same turf. So I don't give Cruz or Paul a pass. I think they're going to go head-to-head, and I wouldn't underestimate Rand Paul's intelligence or his base of support, who are there for his father and a certain, you know, constituency that he owns. I would also say that, look, Christie has this huge benefit, which is he gets to go to the center without looking like a wimp. You can't call him part of the Surrender Caucus. It just doesn't stick to him. I mean, he could say the exact same thing as John Huntsman. Huntsman looks like a wimp, but Chris Christie's personality just won't allow you to tag him as part of that Surrender Caucus meme. So I think that buys him a lot of latitude where he can go to the center, peel off voters, and yet still have the perception of being this hardcore conservative because of his rhetoric and his style. So I like Christie's chances of becoming the nominee, and I think, again, there's all these, you know, the fact that he's a governor, the fact that he's removed from this utter silliness that's happening right now, and he looks like he's actually running something, I think benefits him. But I also think that there is potentially going to be a hunger for someone who can be a strong man, authoritarian, not a dictator, but a tough guy who can whip people
the shade, big daddy.
Get people in line, tell people to shut up and sit down. There's a hunger for that out there. And I think that Christie's like the only guy who could potentially bring that sort, restore that sort of order and discipline to a party that's losing to the Democrats because they are singing off the same choir sheet and Republicans are not.
But so, I mean, but you're not saying that Christie is gaining currency with the conservative movement that has been writing him off for a long time. You just think he might be able to bolster his standing on the center right. Is that correct?
I think that's right. I think that, again, too many variables to game out. But, you know, theoretically what could happen is Cruz and Paul split, sort of split their base. Christie becomes the big money candidate, the establishment candidate. And then they will try to make him out to be a liberal. They will try to tag him as being too liberal, and his personality will overcome that in the debates. He'll have the money to fight them off, and he'll have the personality and the swagger to fight them off. And remember, conservatives conflate ideology with toughness. So Christie's toughness really compensates for his apostasy on the issues.
Of course, that didn't take Rudy Giuliani very far at the end of the day.
I think it's a false analogy between the two. I get what you're saying, but I think that, look, Rudy Giuliani just had too much baggage. He'd been, you know, Christie's only been a governor for a couple years. As far as I know, he hasn't dressed up in drag. As far as I know, Christie hasn't performed a gay marriage himself. As far as I know, Christie hasn't been married, you know, three times or whatever. I mean, Rudy... There are some similarities between Rudy and Christie. I mean, Christie's a governor of a whole state, not just mayor of a city. So I think that it's a flawed analogy to compare them.
But just to go back to what you were saying before. So do you think, so let's say, you know, Jeb Bush doesn't run and, Paul Ryan doesn't run or doesn't get traction. And there's no other kind of, you know, moderate-ish establishment candidate out there, or Rubio doesn't catch on, and so Christie owns that space. If there is a slugfest between Cruz and Paul, and maybe a few other you know, right wing stragglers, would this be like other years where Romney triumphs over the Gingrich Santorum scrap, McCain triumphs over the Huckabee Thompson Romney scrap? Is there enough of an establishment base for Christie to work with if the right fractures? And I guess secondarily, let's say there isn't a Cruz Paul scrap. One of them backs down for the other, and you have a unified right. Is that too much for Christie to take on?
Again, impossible to game this out, too many variables. But look, here's what I think very well could happen. You've got a multitude of stars aligning for Christie, right? So he's going to own, to a certain degree, the establishment money and the establishment vote, number one. Number two, I think it's unlikely that Cruz and Paul, it's unlikely either of them stay out. So I think that they're splitting the votes, at least early on, is likely there will be a fight. So then in the past, we know McCain and Romney have managed to win by virtue of that alone. But now I think there's some sort of new factors that are emerging, including the fact that I think Republicans are getting sick of losing. I think that you know, you say it takes three losing elections, right, before people have their come to Jesus moment, but maybe it'll happen sooner.
Well, and I was thinking about that last night, actually. Does this shutdown fight accelerate that process? Does this effectively become the third loss that makes people you know, snap their necks and straight up and fly right?
Right. It could be, especially if it goes really bad and it forces conservatives to do some reevaluation and some introspection. So that could happen. And I think that stylistically, again, you know, Christie's the opposite of Obama. So there could be people sort of hungry for that. He's a governor. I think that there could be a thirst, even amongst conservatives who would consider themselves to be more conservative than Christie. There's still a hunger for leadership and appreciation of leadership. And if some of these other senators start to look weak, and like they're just not ready for prime time. I'm just saying, I think that the stars might align where, you know, in a different year, a different time, a different era, Chris Christie would have been this fat Joe, you know, Chris Farley figure, you know. But I think it's possible that the stars are aligning where he's just the right man, at the right moment, at the right place. Well, and that happens in, you know, historically from time to time,
sure,
as you know.
Sure.
I mean, but again, you know, otherwise he's Kevin James. You know, from King of Queens. It just all depends.
Kevin James to Obama's a Hitch.
Yes, good. Oh, that what a great buddy comedy those two could do, you know, someday. By the way, one of the funniest, you know, the show King of Queens was so hit or miss, you know. It had flashes of brilliance, but then it would just be mediocre other times. But one of the funniest things I've ever seen on, I mean, this is up there with Chris Farley and Patrick Swayze and the Chippendales actors. One of the funniest things I've ever seen was Kevin James wants his wife, Carrie, played by Leah Remini, to get into this pole dancing, you know, for exercise. Well,
right.
Ostensibly for exercise. Mm-hmm. So Kevin James, like, puts a pole in their bedroom, and he shows her how to do a stripper, like, pole dancing. And it's unbelievable. I mean, you've got this, like, 300-pound guy. He's, like, spinning. He's upside down, sliding down the pole. It's, if you haven't seen it, it's got to be on YouTube. It's, like, hilarious.
But
I love it.
But getting back to what you're saying about, you know, will Republicans be transformed by this shutdown process? You know, what do you have an early read? I mean, leading up to this moment, you and many other, real hardcore conservatives in Washington were waving your hand saying, stop, don't do this, bad idea, bad, bad, bad. But now that it's happened, is there a rally around the conservative flag effect going on? Is it, well, okay, we done it, let's put bygones be bygones, and let's take it to Obama and Reid now, and let's do our best with this? Or is there even more open grousing and please to make this end as quickly as possible?
And we haven't gotten to that yet. It's a wait-and-see attitude as of now. I mean, as we tape this, we're just a few hours into the shutdown. I mean, I don't want to say this is representative of most conservatives, but there certainly is an element of conservatism today that wants the shutdown, that thinks that it's actually part of the plan. It's like in Die Hard when the electricity grid goes down, and, you know, It's a feature, not a bug.
What is that plan then? what happens next?
Well, first of all, they don't think government's important. So if it's shut down, that's,
I mean, is that just the end? Like, well, it's shut down and we won, and we can go about the rest of our business, or is there something they expect to happen next?
No, they expect that Obama will knuckle under next, that he will eventually cave, that public opinion will turn on Obama, and that he will cave in and give up on Obamacare. I mean, I think that's utterly delusional, but I believe that some people really do believe that. Like, I don't think that's just a talking point. Why would you make that? That's a bad talking point. I think that there's an element. Again, I don't want to pretend that it's a majority, but it's out there. But right now we're in a wait-and-see thing. But look, I talked about this sort of tongue-in-cheek a couple weeks ago, Bill, but there could be a silver lining here for Boehner and other Republicans, which is to say, up until now, we've had a sort of protectionist policy where we've said the Republican Party is too big to fail. So whenever people wanted to do really stupid things, we wouldn't let them. We would stop them. And so nothing bad ever happened. It would just be like a slow sort of slouching toward Gomorrah process. But it was never allowed to fail. It was never allowed to bottom out. Well, you know, Bill, in the free market, businesses, bad ideas have to be allowed to fail. You have to let bad ideas fail. And that's creative destruction. And, you know, if you try to prop people up and have these protectionist policies, keep them from ever falling, they never learn their lesson. So there is an argument out there that says that that this needs to be a little bit bad. Republicans need to get blamed, and that will actually be good for Boehner. That will help him, you know, sort of teach these young Turks a lesson.
This gets back to my coup theory, which is that eventually a Boehner will have to put something on the floor that the Tea Party right opposes, that maybe doesn't even have majority of the majority support and gets passed with mainly Democratic votes. And at that point, if that prompts the Tea Party folks to force a coup, Boehner can go to Pelosi and maintain in power that way, offering her immigration reform as incentive. But it's also possible that when that rock bottom is hit, that the coup wouldn't come, that Boehner would essentially have called their bluff and get that majority support because right. They've been taking such a beating up until that point.
I've been thinking about this, Bill, and first of all, I give you credit for once again being at the forefront of public opinion. I think it's true of both of us to some degree, but you are quite often way ahead of the curve. And weeks later, I hear other people say something that you wrote about a couple weeks earlier. Having said that, I've given thought to this. Are you there, Bill? I want to make sure you're still there.
I'm here. You're talking about me. I'm not going to go anywhere.
All right. So when I'm praising you, yeah, just never interfere. You were ahead of the curve. I have given this thought, and I think the more I study Boehner, the more I think that, although it's a fascinating hypothesis, but I don't think it will work for him. And I think there are two things we need to consider. For whatever reason, Boehner seems to put a premium on keeping the Republican coalition together at the expense of his reputation, at the expense of his authority. For whatever reason, that seems to be really important to him, to keep these guys in the party. So I don't see him doing it. The other problem is, if you game this out, remember, we're not dealing with rational people here, necessarily. They're not necessarily going to behave rationally. So if Boehner does this sort of power play, they may, the stuff may hit the fan. And even though they would be outmaneuvered in the House, in other words, if Boehner caucused with Democrats or whatever, they had this grand coalition, it would certainly marginalize this band of rebels within the House. But think of the power that they have with the outside groups. Of what their reaction might be. If you're a political candidate running for office, the pressure that would be on you to go against Boehner, to ally with the rebels. I mean, this could be, if you think we're having an out-and-out war within the Republican Party now, that may be seen as crossing the Rubicon. That could literally... there'll be no coming back from that. Once Boehner crosses that line, it is, it's game on.
Oh, I agree with a lot of that. I think Boehner's a party man first and foremost. He's not a creative sort. He's not a courageous sort. I don't think he would take that leap, probably not until you're right up against a debt default deadline, because I think that is a point that's too far for him to cross. I don't think he would let a debt default happen and spark a global economic depression. If for no other reason that it would kill the Republican Party, it would throw away the House and lose the speakership. So I think that's the kind of thing that would force him to do something that's out of character. But I would note that I just read this on Dean Baker's blog. Is a prominent liberal economist. He pointed out that right now the Treasury has said October 17th, hard deadline. That is the debt default deadline. Got to raise the debt limit by then. But that doesn't factor in shutdown. So if you're not spending as much money because the government shut down, that could push off the deadline. So I don't know exactly when that breaking point for Boehner might be reached.
So you're saying that people who push the shutdown are really heroes, is what you're saying.
Exactly. That's what I was getting to.
American heroes.
So, your other point about the outside groups, because that gets, I think, a larger point that I know you're interested in, which is,
right.
Do we respect our leaders anymore? And I was really struck by a column by Tim Carney in the Washington Examiner, which sort of outlined what's going on with the Republican Party apparatus infrastructure. And he's arguing that because of the earmark ban, which is taking away a leadership tool to keep members in line, and because of Citizens United, which liberals thought was going to lead to the corporations running roughshod over everything, but Carney is making a different take on it, which is it's leading to the rise of these extremist super PACs, which is not speaking for all of corporate America, but individual barons. And that's putting a different kind of an outside conservative pressure on the Republican Party. That's making it much, much harder for the cooler heads in the leadership to crack the whip and keep folks in line anymore. Now everything is scattered to the winds.
Absolutely, though.
So
you've got really a couple of things conspiring. I mean, on one hand, and by the way, I wrote about this phenomenon in a piece about a year ago called John Boehner Cat Herder. And you've really got the culmination of a couple of factors happening. On one hand, you have the institutions of power that have been eroded. Leaders have fewer carrots and sticks. And on the other hand, you have a society where leadership isn't respected anymore. I write about this all the time. It's why you have people like Liz Cheney who think they can just show up and be a U.S. senator, not having lived in the state or been elected to anything. And this is, you know, people, I talk about this all the time. People used to be married to the same woman their whole lives, work at the same companies their whole lives. They retire, they get a gold watch, go to the same church their whole lives, vote for the same political party their whole lives. And our society has changed. And those changes have affected and infected the political process. It's a free agent nation with all the good and bad things that come along with that. And what we're seeing right now happening in Washington, it's easy to blame this current crop, but in many ways, this is like an obvious culmination of various societal factors that have been happening, you know, really for a long time, but really specifically since Vietnam, I would say.
Well, I mean, a lot of this
technology too. I'm sorry.
Right.
Technology. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to make that exact point that technology has sort of broken down all these barriers and, you know, stripped away a lot of the mystique we have about our leaders and our institutions and whatnot. And forgive me if I've told this anecdote before, but there was a New Yorker piece about Google several years ago where Google's meeting with the head of CBS, and Google's explained to them how they have this whole new advertising model where you don't have to make estimates and projections about who's seeing your ads. You have the hard data of clicks, and so the advertisers can pay for exactly what they're getting. And the head of CBS, you know, loses it. He was like, "What are you doing? You're effing with the magic."
it's like Moneyball,
right?
You know,
right.
I mean, it's very similar to Moneyball, where you know the people who've been in the game forever, you know, the scouts. They are personally, not just professionally, but personally invested in the old system.
Well, I mean, take for example the way we reacted to Obama's diplomacy with Syria. You know, that was very, you know, on a knife's edge, a lot of unpredictable developments, a lot of shifts in tactics, and that got derided as this kind of meandering, zigzaggy, improvised foreign policy. You know, what if the Cuban Missile Crisis was happening in this kind of media environment? You know, would that be seen as cool, steely-eyed, you know, hard-edged diplomacy, or would that be seen as the same kind of unpredictable, haphazard outcome? I would gather be looked at minimum very differently than it was looked at back then. And so now, just to take it back to all the shutdown stuff, and this goes to a lot of what's going on in the conservative movement, there seems to be no Republican leader that's capable of saying to the rank and file, trust me, this is the strategically smart thing to do. Please take my word we're talking about.
But going back, you know, but the problem is, Bill, there are people who, there are conservatives who say, this is Moneyball. And you're telling me this is a bad idea because you are part of the establishment and you remember the old days. Your wisdom isn't wisdom. It's conventional. It's based on the old rules. And they'll say, you know, the last government shutdown, you know, Matt Drudge had an email list. Andrew Breitbart, this is from a New York Times article, I think. Andrew Breitbart was a producer at E! E! Entertainment, and Fox News hadn't launched yet, that the world has changed. And so you're predicting that this is going to end badly for us, that we're going to get blamed, but you're operating off of a paradigm that's old-fashioned. Now, I think that they're delusional, but I struggle with this because, you know, being a journalist, being sort of, you know, doing what I do, you're accumulating, hopefully, wisdom and experience that's a template to apply to the next thing that's going to happen. And most of the time when people tell you, oh, yeah, but you don't get it, this is different, they're wrong. Like when a political candidate comes in to meet with you and you're like, well, how much money have you raised or how many doors have you knocked on? And they're like, oh, well, you don't get it, we're doing something different. 99.9% of the time, they will lose because they have this sort of magical thinking. But every once in a while, they're right and you're wrong because the world really has changed and you are wedded to the old ideas. I mean, Bill, do you think it's possible that that I'm out of touch?
Well, what I find odd about that claim for the pro-shutdown conservative to say, you old fogies don't understand that this is different. I've yet to hear, there were folks on the left saying that to Democrats in the Bush years, saying, you can't go on TV and try to sound all reasonable and even-handed when these guys are taking a 2x4 to your head day after day after day. The media has changed, the way that modern dialogue conversation has changed, and you need to have more message coordination and more of a partisan approach to your messaging for your message to be communicated to the public. Otherwise, it gets lost in the clutter. I think that was an accurate critique of what had changed technologically and what had changed in the media infrastructure. And eventually, Democrats got that message, and now they're relatively better. I wouldn't say all the way there, but they're better. When conservatives today are saying, this shutdown fight will be different than other shutdown fights, I don't hear, following that statement, what is actually different. What I see is a lot of cherry-picked poll data to tell themselves they are standing with the broader public and just ignoring a lot of contrary data. I mean, at minimum, you got to take
well,
all
no,
the...
But it is true. I mean, you know, Twitter didn't exist in the last shutdown. Fox News didn't exist during the last shutdown.
But Rush Limbaugh existed in the last shutdown. There's plenty of conservative media in those shutdown days. They had a bad message. They had a bad argument.
It was certainly an.
You could still have a bad argument despite Fox News being around. Not to mention a lot of Fox News are saying don't have a shutdown. It's stupid.
So someone said, I'm going to run this by you, Bill, since you mentioned the rise of these cable TV fighters. Someone recently, and I don't know enough about one of these people to say if this is an analogy or not. Someone said Ted Cruz is Alan Grayson.
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, I don't know much about Alan Grayson.
Well,
is that a fair or an unfair?
I think Alan Grayson would like to be Ted Cruz. I don't think Alan Grayson would, if he ran for the Democratic presidential nomination, would get past, you know, 2-3%.
But would he have, like, five, 10 years ago, wasn't he more popular, like, you know, circa 2005 or something?
Well, I mean, Grayson, I think, has the same level of support now that he did back then. I mean, I think this is the difference between the Democratic and Republican parties right now. I mean, we both have our ideological heroes, quote unquote, that parts of the base revere. But the Democratic Party is a lot less likely to elevate those folks past the second tier. You know, Dennis Kucinich, you know, was always an also-ran, even though he's got a very, you know, loyal following. It's just a small following. There are people who love Alan Grayson out there, no doubt. And Alan Grayson certainly has tried in the Syria debate, you know, to be the Pied Piper against a congressional resolution. Now, we don't know if Grayson would have gotten to the point where he was literally commanding votes the way Cruz seems to right now, because the debate just didn't get that far. I don't think Grayson has ever gotten to that point where, like, he's calling the strategic shots over the heads of Pelosi and Reid. I'm sure he would like to, though, and I'm sure there's a small band out there that would be happy to follow him, but I don't think he's reached that level yet. But I would say there are some parallels there, sure.
Right. Doesn't sound like it's column worthy.
Well, I mean, you know, Cruz has successfully blocked Boehner strategizing repeatedly in his escapade. And I don't think you have a Democrat now who can say, I have overcome the powers of Pelosi and Reid in this fight. You know, that just hasn't happened. So both those guys have a far tighter grip on their caucuses. I mean, in fact, just today, I mean, the fact that the leaders of the Progressive Caucus are saying, we will accept the sequester shows you. I mean, these are people who, if they were on the Republican side, would say, we're not going to do anything. We're never, ever, ever going to vote for something that keeps a sequester. Forget it. You will never have our votes. They don't say that. You know, the Democrats are much more team players.
Look, I would argue that this, I think you're right, but some people would assume that that's because Democrats are more sane than Republicans. I think that what happened is the Republicans picked a really bad time to be in the wilderness. I mean, they're in the wilderness at a time that coincides with all this technological and societal upheaval that we just described. Different scenario if Republicans had the bully pulpit right now on a president. And Democrats had lost two consecutive elections, they may be going crazy. Very well may be going crazy.
But you would think it'd be the opposite. You would think that Democrats would be, now that, I mean, once you've won, you're now at the top of your game, you can actually get stuff done. Usually this is when the coalitions start to break apart, because everybody wants theirs. And it's hard to keep your cats herded, whereas when you're on the outs, you could unify against those in power and put your differences aside. And Democrats have their strains, you know, I think they are largely unified in team players, but that it takes work to keep them together. There certainly are folks who blow off steam and threaten things, and there are things like the Larry Summers nomination, which gets scotched because of blowback. So it's not that everything is completely in lockstep. But when push comes to shove, even though, you know, Dennis Kucinich was on the verge of voting against Obamacare, and, you know,
I see this as like a cyclical thing, sort of like a sports franchise. You know, I mean, I know we've waited all show for this, Bill, so let me just say the Pittsburgh Steelers, last time I checked, have won 6 Super Bowls, and yet they're 0-4 this year. There is chaos in Pittsburgh. So the Democrats had their time in the woods. They had their, a lot of, you know, they had their crazy time in the 70s and 80s and all that. But they didn't, you know, Twitter didn't exist back then and cable news didn't exist back then. And so I think that, you know, if in 1978 or 1982 or whenever you pick the nadir, Twitter had existed and cable news had existed, you know, it would be the Democrats who were in the left, who are, you know, looking really unprofessional and airing their dirty laundry.
In the Carter years, I mean, the party flat out split in two. Ted Kennedy ran against them in the primaries. I mean, that was a very fractured Democratic Party. And then when Reagan won, right, the Democrats were fractured enough that a lot of Democrats crossed the aisle and voted for Reagan's stuff. Yeah, so
that's what I'm saying. And I think that's essentially where the Republicans are at, sort of. But the difference is that it's worse because you've got that plus of all these other trends, where you've got the outside groups exerting more influence. You've got the technology allowing sort of ham and eggers to just sort of rank and file guys to go on TV whenever they want or tweet out a video whenever they want. It's really difficult when you're the party out of power and in chaos. It's very difficult to right that ship.
But it still seems strange to me. I mean, Democrats, I think, were particularly unified in the Bush years. And even when it got testy with the Obama-Clinton primary, you know, that put a big strain on the party. It didn't break the party. Once that was over, even though there was talk of Pumas who were going to sabotage Obama, but they weren't very serious in numbers.
Oh, I totally forgot about
Pumas. Yeah, and there are Puma blogs and Puma YouTubes and all sorts of stuff being flipped, but there never was a critical mass of it. I think there's something different right now in the two parties where, you know, there are certain parallels in ideological spectrum and divisions and whatnot, but there's a certain pragmatism on the Democratic side right now that when it's go time, people push those divisions down and
I think you're right. I think you're right. I completely agree. My only point is that I think it would be wrong for anyone to imply that there's something inherent about liberalism or the Democratic Party that makes them more unified or professional.
Well, it's not historically been that inherent about the
paranoid right that makes them. You're right, Bill. I mean, a study of history would quickly disprove that, but I'm sure that some people will extrapolate that because Republicans appear to be in chaos now, that this has something to do with the paranoid style of American politics on the right or whatever.
Well, it raises the question, is there something different about today's Republican Party and today's, you know, conservative movement?
Well, I think this happens to parties that are having an existential crisis, that are having an identity crisis. And that didn't happen as much as there was bitterness and acrimony between Hillary and Obama. The Democratic Party wasn't having an identity crisis. The Republican Party is. It's a fight for the heart and soul of what it means to be a conservative, let alone a Republican.
And we're having that fight before the third election loss. So perhaps this will be useful for Republicans to accelerate this process and get unified before
2016. I hope that someday school children watch this tape. They can dig up this tape in some time capsule and they can watch what it was like for us to dialogue and have these conversations.
As you know, I'm reading all of my presidential history books lately, and I wonder if you're an historian 30 years from now, 40 years from now, 50 years from now, and you're going back and trying to explain what was this Republican Civil War about exactly, I think there are going to be a lot of very confused historians trying to understand what was going on.
Never mind in the future. Try explaining to your kids, you know, to a 10-year-old kid or something, why the government's shutting down.
Well, let's leave it on that note with a note of gloom and doom for the next generation.
I am deemed an essential worker here, so I will be on task doing the DMZ. All right, everyone.
But have a happy shutdown day anyway.
You too.
Enjoy your freedom.
All right. See ya.
Bye.